This year marks the 40th anniversary of the first documented case in the U.S. of what would go on to be called AIDS. Reporter Maureen McKinney is examining the early years of the epidemic and what's happened since as part of our ongoing series, AIDS at 40. She talked with Danville native Arlen Miller. He tells the story of how he lost his partner, Mike Walsh, more than three decades ago.
I went to learn how to be an AIDS buddy, and my partner Mike happened to be at the training the same day I was, and we met during a break and started dating pretty quickly thereafter. He was one of the smartest guys that I ever knew. He had a killer combination of devastating blue eyes, good looks, and a great sense of humor, and was just really very personable. He went to Georgetown as an undergrad and got a degree in international finance, and then he went to law school at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He had a lot of offers from a lot of high-powered law firms to make a lot of money, and he decided that he didn't want to do that, and he wanted to go into civil rights law. In retrospect, I think he was at that AIDS buddy training looking for a partner who would take care of him, and so he found him. The biggest thing was, you know, how could I continue the relationship with him and stay safe myself? And the answer to that was yes. So we just kind of went for it, and we were together, I want to say, 2.5 years before he died. We had a few dates, and actually in bed one morning and going to have sex, and then he proceeded to lecture me about how I needed to be more careful, and then told me that one of the reasons I needed to be more careful was because he was HIV positive. The funny thing about Mike was that right up until 6 months before he died, he never had anything to me that was more than an inconvenience. So he was on an experimental AIDS treatment, and he got onto that protocol because they were conducting the study. And primarily he did that because he didn't have medical insurance, and that was a way for him, one, to get on a protocol with a drug that might be life-saving, and two, to have regular medical care. And then in August of 1990, he started having a lot of headaches all the time. And long story short, it turned out to be an AIDS-related brain tumor. So he, from August to early November, so it was really only a couple of months from the time he really got sick until he died. I think that that all of his symptoms and the brain tumor were related to the trial drug that he was on. One night I was out with a friend, and he called me and he was like, please come home. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm trying to talk and I can't say what I want to say. And he was kind of like he was locked inside of his body. He had no control over his speech functions, and that lasted for a few weeks. He got quickly worse and worse, but I was still trying to work and keep everything together because, you know, at the time we met, he didn't have a job. And I had a really busy job, traveling a lot. I had a very supportive boss who knew the whole story. And most of the people that I worked with, everybody was pretty supportive through that whole period. But there were times when it was just a little overwhelming. He ended up going into the hospital at NIH. And that was when I kind of told his sister-in-law, it's like, you need to tell his family if they ever want to see him again and see the person that they knew, they need to come now. You know, everybody kind of got to see him while he was still with it. And then he was in the hospital for a couple of weeks. And one day I went to visit him and the nurse took me aside and said, okay, well, it's time for Mike to go home. And I'm like, why? And she's like, well, there's nothing else we can do for him here. I had thought throughout the course of our relationship about the fact that Mike was eventually going to die. But then it was like really right in my face, like, oh, what am I supposed to do about this? And then they just kind of took us through the Cliff Notes version of how to help someone die. And that included, you know, saying, well, you know, he's obviously never going to get better. So when he starts getting really sick, then it's all about comfort measures. And that's all you care about is just keeping him comfortable until he dies. So they loaded me up with like a bag of cotton swabs that had lemon and glycerin to swab his mouth out with. And then they gave me liquid morphine and kind of gave me the Cliff Notes on how to use that. He eventually went into a coma while he was at our house, and we had moved him from our bedroom into a sun porch and kind of set up like a hospital room in there. We had a hospital bed, and there was like a nonstop stream of his friends coming to see him while he was still lucid. And then it got to the point where he lapsed into a coma. And so for like, I want to say it was like 2.5 weeks, all we listened to every day was his rasping breath. And it was just like 24 hours a day. When he would make noises and we thought maybe he was uncomfortable, then we would go to his bedside and administer some liquid morphine. The last week, I was sleeping on a little wicker sofa next to Mike's bed, and I fell asleep. And what woke me up was the absence of the rasping breath, and it was like the room was silent. I walked over to his bedside and he had stopped breathing. And so I put my hand on his chest and said his name. And then there was like all of a sudden this huge intake of breath. And that was it. Went to the door of Carl's bedroom and knocked on the door and said, Carl, can you come up here? You know, I let him know that Mike had died, and he's like, okay, I'm going to go get my mom and dad because I want my mom to be able to hug him while he's still warm. And so his mom and dad came and said their goodbyes, and then we called the coroner, and then I watched them take him out of the house in a body bag, and that was it. What we learned was you save the drugs and give the drugs to somebody who can use them. And so as it happened, a lot of my friends were dying at the same time Mike died. And I want to say it was like maybe not even a week after he died, another friend of ours called who his partner had been a lobbyist, and he and Mike had been really good friends. And Nick was his partner, and he called me up and he's like, well, I'm pretty sure Jim is going to die any day now, and I don't know what to do. And so I gather up all my liquid morphine and my cotton swabs that NIH had given me. I was like, I'll be over and I'll give you the Cliff Notes that they gave me. And then just a couple of days later, Jim died. So it was just probably for a space of like 2 months, it was nonstop. I think I lost like 5 or 6. One really exceptionally close friend died probably just a few days before Mike. And then a rapid succession, like all I did was go to memorial services probably for about a month. I remember the year after Mike died, I sent a Christmas card to a friend of his who had been very helpful. And I got a letter back from his brother who said, hey, got your Christmas card. Sorry to tell you that Rick has died. And he was an engineer at NASA. I was thinking about this the other day because they have all the white flags symbolizing all the people who died of COVID. Well, during the 1992 March on Washington, and they unrolled the National AIDS quilt, it went from the Washington Monument to the Capitol. Mike just really symbolized, you know, the waste of a whole generation of gay men left. And, you know, the rest of us just had to pick up the pieces.
That's Danville native Arlen Miller. He lost his partner, Mike Walsh, more than 3 decades ago, and he told his story as part of our ongoing series, AIDS at 40, marking the anniversary of the first documented AIDS case in the U.S.